WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. A federal judge has now dismissed charges of involuntary manslaughter against two U.S. Park police officers.
The two Park police officers fatally shot unarmed motorist Bijan Gaisar back in November of 2017 after Gaisar was rear-ended on the GW Parkway, then led officers on a confusing stop-and-start chase. Fairfax County Commonwealth's attorney Steve Descano had charged both officers with involuntary manslaughter last year, but U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton tossed out those charges, declaring the actions of the officers, quote, necessary and proper in the shooting of 25-year-old Bijan Gaisar. Barbara Britt, WMAL and WMAL.com.
A violent struggle between police and an armed man leaves two D.C. officers injured and a suspect injured. Police Chief Robert Conti says someone told officers an armed man with a cast was chasing another person. They found the man, frisked him, and found a gun in his waistband. He ran off and got into a car as they tried to get him out.
As they were trying to remove him from the vehicle, another officer, in an attempt to get the individual out of the vehicle, entered into the vehicle.
The officer wound up jumping from the vehicle as it was moving and was hurt. Another also hurt while the vehicle driving off. The suspect wound up going to a hospital also with injuries. We're learning more about Alec Baldwin shooting and killing a cinematographer in a movie set. Court records show an assistant director unwittingly handed Baldwin a loaded weapon and told him it was safe to use. Turns out it was loaded with live rounds.
Exactly what the prop gun fired is under investigation. The Santa Fe Sheriff's Office releasing a statement writing in part, this investigation remains open and active. No charges have been filed in regard to this incident. Witnesses continue to be interviewed by detectives. Baldwin tweeting, there are no words to convey my shock and sadness. I'm fully cooperating with the police investigation to address how this tragedy occurred.
Fox's Matt Finn. Virginia's Democratic gubernatorial candidate is relying on some star power in the closing days of the race.
Former President Obama will join Terry McAuliffe at a rally in Richmond, Virginia this afternoon, the latest high-profile Democrat to boost enthusiasm in a race that polls suggest is very close. McAuliffe is running against Republican Glenn Youngkin, a former equity firm CEO and first-time candidate. Next week, President Biden is expected to campaign for McAuliffe. Jared Halpern, Fox News.
It's National Drug Take-Back Day. Police stations around our area want you to bring them your unused meds. WMAL Sports, the Wizards beat the Pacers 135-134 in overtime. The Caps face the Flames this afternoon, and the Astros are heading to the World Series after beating the Red Sox 5-0 in Game 5 of the ALCS. They'll face either the Braves or Dodgers on Tuesday. Traffic and weather next. WMAL Traffic and Weather. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the Virginia side of the Beltway in Alexandria, in a loop, slow traffic between the local lane split and Van Dorn Street. No delays on the outer loop of the Beltway in Virginia, by the way. On 66 westbound in Vienna, there is a crash. Right lane is blocked at exit 62 just after Nutley Street. And on 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, go ahead and set your cruise control on the northbound side and on the southbound side. All lanes are clear. And there are no delays on 295, 395, and 695 in the district. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, partly sunny, a high near 68. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 50. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a high near 71. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, a low around 59. Monday, a chance of late afternoon showers, otherwise partly sunny, a high near 76. I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday morning update.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. It's hour two, and we are joined by John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
President Biden holding a town hall hosted by CNN on Thursday night, even though he was in friendly territory, didn't play so well for him the next day. How about the fallout?
Well, the fallout is, once again, Joe Biden failed to assure the American public that he was completely in charge and ahead on all policies. Now, Anderson Cooper was a very friendly interviewer. The president did not have difficult or complex questions, and he spoke from the heart. The two senators who are holding up his infrastructure program, Democrats Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, he praised. He called Manchin a friend, even though the senator from West Virginia had been flirting, not too secretly, with leaving the Democratic Party to become an independent. And of Arizona's Sinema, he said, and I quote, "She's smart as the devil." Nonetheless, it was not enough, really, to close the deal that he is in charge. And this is going to continue to the malaise that surrounds the White House and possibly have some fallover in the November gubernatorial elections.
You know, it's interesting that the headlines coming out about his comments on Taiwan, this one from ABC News, U.S. cleans up Biden's commitment to defend Taiwan from Chinese invasion. The Biden administration again playing cleanup after President Joe Biden said the U.S. would come to Taiwan's defense in the event of an invasion by mainland China, despite decades of policy that leaves that an open question. And Newsweek, Pentagon corrects defense secretary on China and Taiwan after White House fixes Biden remarks.
The president stated what many assume is the 1978 Taiwan Relations Act's language. In other words, if Taiwan were to be attacked by China, that the U.S. would send in warships and planes to defend it. I asked Jen Psaki this question on October 14th, and the White House press secretary gave the traditional response. We stand by the 1978 Taiwan Relations Act and oppose any effort beyond that of the Taiwanese to have a change in government. That has been an answer that spokesmen and presidents have been saying for years. Joe Biden went a step further. We have a commitment to defend Taiwan. And this, in effect, gave the green light to our sending forces in if the island nation were ever attacked by the communist colossus 90 miles away. In response to that, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the press office simply reiterated the Taiwan Relations Act, which is deliberately worded in a murky way so as not to sound like a prospective declaration of war. When the president said what he did at his town hall meeting, the immediate question was, has he changed policy toward Taiwan?
You mentioned Joe Manchin a few minutes ago, and you wrote a story about Joe Manchin this week. The headline, "Did Manchin threaten to bolt Dems or didn't he?" Apparently there was a dust-up with Bernie Sanders and a lot of fur flying around Joe Manchin these days.
According to the publications, Axios and Salon, the moderate senator from West Virginia could care less if the Biden infrastructure plan, the crown jewel of the White House that the president's spokesman repeatedly says is transformative, he could care less if there was no bill at all, or so he supposedly said at a regular luncheon of senators. But according to Mother Jones, Senator Manchin went a step further, saying that he would gladly leave the Democratic Party and become an American independent, that he would inform Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of these intentions, and very possibly caucus with the Republicans, something that in the evenly divided Senate would flip control and make Mitch McConnell majority leader once again. Now, after this was presented to him, Senator Manchin said, "It's BS," saying exactly what that stands for. And he added, "I can't control speculation." Then the subsequent reports appeared that he did indeed say this in the presence of other senators. David Korn, who wrote the story for Mother Jones, said his source was unimpeachable and Joe Manchin knows it. I might add, I spoke to a couple of Republicans in the Mountaineer states, and they don't believe that it will ever happen. Joe Manchin is the last Democrat in statewide office, and the only Democrat in West Virginia's congressional delegation.
Well, you mentioned flipping seats. There could be some seat flipping in the governor's mansion in Virginia. What's the very latest on the tightening of the race there?
Most major polls show it to be a dead heat. The Trafalgar poll had it as a tie between former Governor Terry McAuliffe, Democrat, and first-time candidate Glenn Youngkin, Republican. I might add that even with campaign assistance from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and Barack Obama, McAuliffe is still locked in a standoff. Some of this appeared to show when he was on an ABC affiliate interview, and this being filmed, he went on for about 10 minutes answering questions about the race and some other things that were controversial, things he'd said about his opponent. And finally, he stepped up and walked off the stage, taking off the mic. When the interviewer suggested he come back another time, he said, maybe you'll ask better questions then. I might add that opponent Youngkin went through the full session with the same interviewer and comment later that a governor has to speak to people who disagree with him and handle tough questions. Overall, it was clearly a net gain for Youngkin, and some old-timers in the punditocracy say this was the most devastating appearance on television by a candidate for governor since 1962, when Alabama's Democratic former governor Jim Folsom, attempting a comeback, appeared on TV, clearly inebriated, and forgot the names of his children.
Ouch. Did he win or lose?
He lost. And that precipitated the rise of George Wallace.
Interesting. Let's turn to New Jersey, because that race is tightening as well, isn't it?
Look, most of us who cover state politics have paid more attention to Virginia than New Jersey. It was always assumed that in a state in which Joe Biden won by 15 percentage points last fall, Democratic Governor Phil Murphy could mail in his reelection campaign. But after his second televised debate with Republican challenger Jack Cittarelli, the governor found himself leading by his tightest margin yet, 50-44%, according to the respected Emerson poll. Now, some say this is just voter anger in the Garden State regarding COVID and vaccinations and mask rules. Not so, says Emerson. Murphy raised taxes, and fully 50% of Jersey voters say taxes is the most important issue. 16% say that jobs are the most important issue, and only 13% say health care is. In any event, history is against Governor Murphy, the state's composition notwithstanding. The last time a Democratic governor of New Jersey won a second term was 1977, under the late Governor Brendan T. Byrne.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. We'll be watching you on Twitter this week to see how much trouble you get into with the White House. Thank you very much, John.
Okay. How do I retort something like that? Thank you, Rick.
We've got Cheryl Atkinson up next, but first, Al BD's in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
I have a Maryland traffic update for you on the Beltway in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. Right now, there isn't any crashes and no construction has been set up. You'll be at the posted speed limit. If you're traveling between the two Beltways in Prince George's County on the BW Parkway or on 95, northbound and southbound lanes are clear. In Prince George's County on Route 50 between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, you're not going to hit the brakes on the eastbound side or on the westbound side. And on 270 in Montgomery County, it's clear between the Beltway and Frederick, northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
A fair amount of clouds to start the day as we head towards the beginning of the weekend. Expect the chance for some isolated showers. Now, they should be few and far between. You're not expecting much in the way of precipitation. We're well below as far as the precipitation is concerned, over 2 inches below for the month of October. Not going to be making that up today, but we'll have the chance for a little bit of sunshine through the afternoon, so that is a good thing. Highs today in the upper 60s. As we head tonight, lows back in the 40s and 50s under mostly cloudy skies. Partly cloudy and round out the weekend on Sunday. Dry conditions expected. High temperatures near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
55 degrees in the nation's capital, 718 on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is a Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. It's good to have you with us. And Cheryl Atkinson joins us. She is the host of Full Measure. That's tomorrow morning, ABC 7 at 10 o'clock. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Reading here from a story in the New York Times on Friday, the 1.7 million migrants encountered in the last 12 months, the highest number of illegal crossings recorded since at least 1960s. Illegal border crossings soar to record highs. We see a lot of stories about the Border Patrol, but the Coast Guard has a role. Tell us about that.
Well, before we get to that, let me say I think I'm the only one who said this, and I'm not sure why. This will be, it's shaping up to be, unless there's some weird change in the numbers, this fiscal year an all-time record ever for illegal immigration into the United States. Illegal border crossings. I think it's going to be 2 million. The fiscal year, I believe, starts, is it October 1st or October 31st? So we're just coming to the end of that or just came to the end. And I think you're going to see 2 million. And this is just huge. You know, people I was reading earlier were saying things like in recent months, oh, the worst since, you know, the 2000 time period. And I looked up the stats to see it's going to be the worst ever. You know, I'm 99% sure based on the stats that we have so far. But the Coast Guard, when I was in Texas reporting recently, the Coast Guard was there, and I'd never seen the Coast Guard in all my trips to the border before, and they're patrolling the Rio Grande. So we went out on a trip with them to find out why this unusual mission, and it is unusual. And it turns out that several months ago, as this border crisis built, the Department of Homeland Security assigned Coast Guard folks, the guys I talked to, there were women too, but the guys only on the boat that I was on, they're from Louisiana. And they're being assigned to this, again, very unusual assignment for the Coast Guard, helping patrol the Rio Grande. And I will tell you, they're not stopping anybody. That's not their job. What they're doing is kind of what you see on TV. They're rescuing people if they see them, kind of crossing in the river, kind of going up and down. But they're there to help, and it's, again, a sign of how things have devolved along the border.
You have been in Puerto Rico to report on a story that was in the news very recently, and it relates to the money that we will pour into emergency relief, going in, trying to repair infrastructure, replace infrastructure. There's always waste. What did you find in Puerto Rico?
Well, Rick, I don't know if people know this, but the tax money we gave to Puerto Rico after the 2017 hurricanes, there was Maria and another one after the other. That's the biggest amount of money we've ever spent on a natural disaster relief effort. And the biggest single chunk of that went to their electric grid in Puerto Rico. People probably remember it was a mess even before all of this. So they got enough money to supposedly, we heard, rebuild the whole thing. Well, it turns out that initial money was enough to do emergency work, but they've gotten a whole bunch more, billions more, to do the big rebuild. Fast forward to this past week, about in the last week or so, and there was a testimony to Congress that said the Puerto Rican electric grid is on the verge of collapse after all of that. So I think it's a really fascinating follow-the-money story. And I'm reporting from Puerto Rico. I spoke to one of the executives with a company called Luma. Luma was hired in a very unusual privatization effort to try to get all of this sorted out in Puerto Rico. So I'll be talking to him about the challenges and what's going wrong or what's not going right very early in this process since Luma has taken over.
In these situations, you often hear about corruption. It's a big story for a week, and then it sort of goes away, and then you kind of ask the question, is there follow-up? Are there prosecutions? Are there investigations? What can you tell us when it comes to that kind of accountability?
Well, you're right. Well, I would say two things. Sometimes they do something about it, and the media doesn't follow it up. And we have actually followed the Puerto Rico money, done several stories on this, and I have another one I'm working on coming up, but I will give you a little preview. Yes, the FBI is prosecuting numerous officials in Puerto Rico, including a former Obama Homeland Security official who was in charge of some FEMA efforts during this hurricane. Her name is Asha Tribble, and she got caught. This is a typical scheme you hear. This is alleged. A typical scheme you hear in Puerto Rico is money comes in, big money, and these officials funnel contracts to people they know in exchange for all kinds of things like luxury apartments and fancy cars and favors. And this is sort of a way of doing business for a lot of people in Puerto Rico. So later in the season, I'm going to talk to a top FBI official there. That's job one for him, about why so much official corruption in Puerto Rico kind of has something to do with, he says, their Spanish colony heritage, and he's Puerto Rican, by the way, but how it's kind of a way of life there. It's kind of hard to get out of that mindset.
So many of the Biden administration policies have been a change or just flat-out rejection of Trump administration policies. One of those that has changed has been our policy toward Israel. And how does that impact Israel, the U.S., and in terms of their dealing with Iran, and then we've seen the mess in Afghanistan? I mean, that's got to be straining the relationship with Israel.
It is. You know, I think I learned as a young journalist many years ago, we often talk past people when we're reporting on foreign developments, partly because, again, when I was younger, I didn't understand a lot of them myself. I had to do a lot of reading and catch up. And then we report things over people's heads when they haven't had the time to do their own research. So Scott Thuman goes to Israel for us this week and breaks down, I think, in easy-to-understand terms, why all that's going on in the Mideast impacts us and why it's important. And one of the things he found out that I think is really crucial is the way we got out of Afghanistan, that botched withdrawal and the reputation it's given us in the Middle East, is directly impacting an increased threat seen there now, where there's a belief that the Islamic extremist Taliban, now back in charge in Afghanistan, have this sort of axis of evil or axis of terror that they can form, working with the Islamic extremists in Iran and Pakistan. And remember, the prime goal or a prime goal of these groups is the annihilation of Israel and the United States. All of this is impacting Israel. All of this stands to impact our standing in the Middle East. So Scott's going to report from Jerusalem on all of that this week.
It's all tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock, full measure, and mention of CherylAtkison.com, Cheryl's website. A lot of great stories there. So if you have some time over the weekend, you can check that out as well. Cheryl, as always, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great one.
And you too. 7:25 Saturday morning update, WMAL. 7:30 news coming up with Heather Curtis, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland waiting in the wings.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. A D.C. police officer is injured after jumping out of a moving vehicle driven by an armed man, according to police. Another officer also injured. Chief Robert Conte says police found a gun while frisking a man.
A violent struggle began between that individual and several of our officers. That person was able to break away from our officers. He fled to a nearby alley where there was a vehicle. He was able to enter into that vehicle, and once inside of that vehicle, our officers chased him.
One officer got in the car. Conte says it sped off, injuring one officer. As the suspect was driving down Kennedy Street, an officer shot the man. The officer inside the car jumped out. The suspect and both officers wound up in hospitals. If you're shopping for everything from cat food to building supplies, you may find what you want out of stock. A backlog of cargo ships at the nation's largest port continues.
A record 109 ships wait to offload their cargo. Half don't even have an assigned place to anchor just outside the ports, forcing the rest to simply drift in waters well outside San Pedro Bay. Going to 24/7 operations was supposed to jumpstart improvements in the supply chain. Right now, there's no evidence it has. Truckers say a shortage of warehouse workers is one problem. The other, a lack of chassis to haul containers.
Fox's William Lajeunesse. The White House says it's hoping to fix the supply chain problems by Christmas. WMAL Sports, the Wizards beat the Pacers 135-134. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic, here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In the district on 295, 395, and 695, no reports of any construction or any crashes. You should find all lanes clear and at the posted speed limit. On the Maryland side of the Beltway from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, you're not going to tap the brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, that's clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop. Staying in Virginia on 66 in Fairfax County, all clear eastbound and westbound. And on 95 in Virginia, you're not going to tap the brakes between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, partly sunny, a high near 68. Tonight, partly cloudy, a low around 50. Right now, 60 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, 105.9 FM, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update. We're at 7:35. We're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research, and he is the author of Operation Dark Heart. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
All right, so we are seeing reports out of China, and a report yesterday in American Military News, the headline on it, U.S. military hypersonic missile test fails days after China flies one around the globe. And I know Henry Cooper wrote an article over at Newsmax about it, and he quoted Gordon Chang and also quoted the U.S. disarmament ambassador Robert Wood, who said that, quote, Washington is concerned about China's possible deployment of hypersonic weaponry and that the U.S. hadn't developed a means of countering it. Where does that put us?
So, yeah, by the way, Gordon Chang and Ambassador Cooper are both in our organization, Lem Center. The hypersonic issue is something not unknown to those studying this issue. Rick, this technology was developed by us back decades ago. Sandia Lab played a significant role. You can go check out Ambassador Cooper's article where he talks about this on Newsmax, playing hypersonic catch-up with Russia and China. So, again, people are studying this. Problem is the policymakers who need to be making decisions to support getting it fielded are not doing that. And that crosses all party lines. This means the Bush White House, Obama, Trump, and now back to Biden. So the concern is there's certain orbits we have a hard time following trajectories, the polar orbit in particular. You combine that with this new technology, which is very hard to track, and it creates a true challenge to our ability to defend the United States. The good news is there are ways we know to defend against it. There's some technologies that were developed under SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, that could actually be used to effectively counter it, but again, they have not been fielded. So it's not as bad as I think some people have portrayed it to be, but it's not nearly as good as it should be based on our basically inventing this technology, our knowledge of what it is and how it works, and trying to make sure that we can get ahead of it to make sure it's not used against us. So that's kind of the long and short of the issue.
So that's the military side of things with China as of this morning. On the political front, this from the AP, China on Friday said there is no room for compromise or concessions over the issue of Taiwan. That follows the comments by President Joe Biden that the U.S. is committed to defending the island if it is attacked. I know that's been a tricky policy for us, and that the wording has been very ambiguous about what we would do in the event of an attack on Taiwan. But the president kind of stepped into it Thursday night in that CNN town hall.
He steps into a lot of things, but in this one, I tend to agree with him. The policy has always been ambiguous, but behind the scenes, if you talk to any military planner, we have always dedicated a great deal of military force in our planning to be able to respond to defend Taiwan. And Rick, if you recall, we spent a lot of time sending ships over into that region. There's been some confrontations with us and the communist Chinese over this issue several times. So while I think President Biden's statement was, quote-unquote, a change of policy, it's really not. And I do believe it is in our interest to actually defend Taiwan because we do have that agreement, and it's the right thing to do. Plus, the economic issue of this is huge. I don't think people understand how much we depend on Taiwan as a partner and a lot of the technology we take for granted. You've just seen the chip shortage. You just saw the chip shortage with the whole issue of cars. That's because Taiwan's having a hard time copying those things out. So that's something to consider as we look at this situation regarding what Biden said.
Hey, I want to turn to the supply chain crisis because it's impacting everybody. Obviously, with getting anything online or Christmas shopping now, they're talking about holiday shopping issues that could come up. What about the military supply chain?
Well, I think the solution for both the military and the commercial supply chain is the same. Buy American, build American. This is one of those things that London Center has actually been trying to create critical mass on, believe it or not, with Rutgers University. We've been looking at the school, with the School of Business, of how we can create a kind of a justification study to look at how we can do that. And there's aspects, Rick, of the military issue, which I think we're not looking at seriously enough. First, critical materials. What are those things that are manufactured and brought back from overseas that the military depends upon? That includes things like I just mentioned, ship. What kind of raw materials need access to that we will always need if we even manufacture those things ourselves? So, again, everything we're talking about this morning is not political, although it becomes political because of politicians unwilling to actually do the right things and establish the right policies. But the supply chain failing right now is, I would argue, artificial. Everything is there, just not being properly moved. But more importantly, for the military and national security, there are things that you cannot remove or lack if you want to have an effective military. So beyond the woke issues, if you simply don't have the material to run the military, you're going to have a real problem.
And I thought it was ironic to see that there is a border wall being constructed.
Yeah.
In Rehoboth Beach, around the president's home, while we've got millions of dollars of border wall rusting down along the southern border. I don't know how that struck you.
Well, real quick on that, Rick. Look, most people will never make in 2 years the money they're spending on this so-called wall around the president's beach house in Rehoboth. It's not only tone deaf, it's completely insane when you regard the fact that there are elements of the border wall which would be effective. Everybody's agreed on its effectiveness, yet you have Secretary Mayorkas refusing to do those basic things that would make the American people safe. And again, it goes, all roads go back to Joe Biden. So this is a conscious decision to waste money, I would argue, on a beach house for the president, while real whole stretches of the border are left unsecure and open for this record-breaking flood of illegal immigrants coming across the border. It's completely insane.
Well, it's classic. You know, he tells Anderson Cooper in the town hall that he's been so busy he hasn't had time to get down to the border, but he's got plenty of time to get down to Rehoboth.
Well, those reruns of Matlock are going to watch themselves, so he's got a lot of time to do that.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the host of the Thought to Action podcast at londoncenter.org. What's on this week?
We're going to be doing something on the hypersonic issue, and I think we're still running our Andy Biggs, Representative Andy Biggs special on Afghanistan. So be sure and check it out.
You bet. I think you nailed it on Matlock. Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
743, Saturday Morning Update, WMAL. We'll talk to KT McFarland coming up next, but first, Al B. D's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, southbound traffic is slow in Woodbridge between 123 and the Prince William Parkway. On the Beltway in Virginia, inner loop and outer loop, I just checked out the traffic cameras. All lanes are clear and you're at the posted speed limit. In Fairfax on 66, eastbound lanes are clear and the westbound lanes, no construction and no crashes. And in D.C. right now on 295, 395, and 695, go ahead and set your cruise control. All lanes are at the posted speed limit. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
A fair amount of clouds to start the day as we head towards the beginning of the weekend. Expect the chance for some isolated showers. Now, they should be few and far between. You're not expecting much in the way of precipitation. We're well below as far as the precipitation is concerned, over 2 inches below for the month of October. Not going to be making that up today, but we'll have the chance for a little bit of sunshine through the afternoon, so that is a good thing. Highs today in the upper 60s. As we head tonight, lows back in the 40s and 50s under mostly cloudy skies. Partly cloudy and round out the weekend on Sunday. Dry conditions expected. High temperatures near 70 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
55 degrees in the nation's capital, 745 on the Saturday Morning Update. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We're at 747. We are joined by KT McFarland, former Deputy National Security Advisor in the Trump administration, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, great to have you with us.
Terrific to be with you, too.
Thank you. You've authored an opinion piece at foxnews.com And the headline on it, Colin Powell's greatest gift to us all. Colin Powell represents what our military can and should be. And you had known Colin Powell for over three decades. You first met him, during the Reagan years?
Actually, even more than that. Yeah, I mean, in the early 1980s. I first met him when we were both at the Pentagon. I was the speechwriter to the Secretary of Defense, and he was the military assistant. And we were kind of, so our offices were right next to each other, and we were kind of an odd pair. I mean, there were very few black flag officers in the military, and there were even fewer women in the Pentagon senior leadership. So we would kind of joke about it sometimes. Anyway, we were the only ones in the room, put it that way, of our own type. But the important part of what I saw as Colin Powell's development as a strategic thinker was during those years, Secretary of Defense Weinberger was worried that the United States might be drawn again into another war we couldn't win, like Vietnam, but this time in the Middle East. And he got permission from President Reagan to lay out a war-fighting doctrine for the post-Vietnam world, and I was asked to write the speech draft. So the first thing I did was go to Colin Powell and ask him, okay, so what were the lessons we learned about Vietnam? And he talked about the frustrations of fighting in a war with vague and ever-changing objectives and without the support of the American people. And I think he spoke for a lot of members of his generation of veterans that if America went to war, it should be for a darn good reason and we should go to win. So my speech draft became known as the Weinberger Principles of War, and President Reagan endorsed it, and it laid out a series of guidelines for when and how the U.S. should go to war with clearly defined goals, objectives, resources, and only in defense of our vital national interests and only with the support of the American people. So when Colin Powell, fast forward a decade, Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the first Gulf War in the George H.W. Bush administration, and he fought and won that first Gulf War by those same principles, especially in what's known as the Powell Doctrine of using overwhelming force. So that went really well. He followed the rules or he followed the guidelines. Fast forward another decade to after September 11th, 2001. And so we went into Afghanistan. We destroyed all but a handful of Al-Qaeda in a few short months. But George Bush's neoconservative advisors, they pushed to invade Iraq before we'd even finished Afghanistan. Invade Iraq and then convince them that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and he was about to use them. Well, Secretary Colin Powell was less convinced than the others in that administration, and he reluctantly, but did, go to the UN and made the case for attacking Iraq, deposing Saddam Hussein, destroying the weapons of mass destruction, blah, blah, blah. Well, he later regretted that as probably the biggest mistake of his life. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but like in Afghanistan, we stayed in Iraq after we had completed our mission and tried to nation build and set up permanent bases. And as Colin Powell had predicted internally in that administration, it wouldn't end well, and it didn't. And so for me, I look at Colin Powell, his life bookended Vietnam and Afghanistan. And in the middle were people who kept advocating that we go to these places, get in the middle of civil wars, try to build modern democracies, leave permanent U.S. bases, and it never worked. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, we start with really good intentions, but we ultimately failed. So when I look at him as a sort of emblematic of who he was and what he was the template for everything great about America, and he believed that in his heart, that poor black kid from the Bronx, son of immigrants, rose to become this iconic American hero. And whether you liked what he did or didn't do in his policies, the thing about him that was so amazing was he lived by a very different set, which today seems so old-fashioned, right? He like a lifetime ago. The principles that he learned and he lived by, and he wasn't political, and he didn't involve himself in national affairs. He was asked to run for president. He didn't want to do it. And so I think the greatest gift for Americans right now would be to go look at what Colin Powell said about how warfighting doctrine, dust that principle off. That should be a starting point for how we think of our sort of purpose in warfighting, our military, our adversaries, and our national purpose. And then look at what he was. He was what the military used to be and could be again and is not today with the woke political generals who lose war after war after war.
Well, let us contrast the leadership of people like Colin Powell to our leadership today. And we saw the president on the town hall meeting on Thursday night. Then Friday, it was cleanup on aisle 9 at the White House. Also, the Pentagon had to do some cleanup. Everybody comes out of these scratching their head and even more and more concerned. And we see more and more of the traditionally liberal media outlets also scratching their heads. And the headlines in the lower third, the chyrons on the screen, they're asking the same questions we've asked for years.
Yeah, look, I think that the media had been, instead of covering Joe Biden and the Democrats, they've been covering up for Joe Biden and the Democrats, and that's coming to an end. What strikes me about the whole Biden administration is like with Jimmy Carter, to go back to the Colin Powell era, it's just the passivity of them. I mean, and the confusion, how President Biden will say one thing, but the aides always have to clean up after him. And it gives the impression that sort of nobody's in charge, especially not the president. And, I mean, for example, they're held hostage by the socialist wing of the Democrat Party over the spending and the Green New Deal and all the other things, the so-called infrastructure plan. None of that stuff is stuff Biden campaigned on, but yet that's the stuff he's peddling. And then when you go to foreign policy, they talk tough about China, but they shrink from any action, military, economic, or otherwise. So when the Chinese test a hypersonic weapon, what does the Biden administration do? Not say, we're going to build our own, or we're increasing defense spending, or we're going to make sure that they don't take over the South China Sea. They sort of shrug. And they say, well, you know, we welcome competition. And then at the minute President Biden at the town hall where he said, well, we're going to defend Taiwan, whoops, the administration's sort of cleanup team had to come out and say, well, it's not really what they meant, and we're going to give them some weapons. But and now it appears that they did that in immediate response to China complaining about what Biden said. And yet there are others who were saying, okay, here's the solution, like Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State, likely contender in the 2000 presidential elections. He said, let's give Taiwan the weapons they need to defend themselves by themselves. That's all Biden had to say, but he couldn't do it. And then, like the supply chain shortages, the White House press secretary, she just makes snarky remarks. And there's a solution, though. Governor DeSantis of Florida, he says, look, we have a lot of ports in Florida. They already work 24/7. They have a lot of extra capacity. Bring those ships that are container ships that are idling off of Long Beach Harbor in California for 2 weeks. Bring them to Florida. We'll unload them. And then the killer is inflation. No president survives inflation, period. And they keep saying, oh, it's a temporary glitch, but what are people supposed to do in the meantime? And they say gas prices now $6, $8 a gallon is the price of California. What do they say? Oh, just a temporary glitch. But anyway, you should buy electric cars. And the cumulative effect of all this is that American people, you guys are on your own. Especially the working class, don't expect help from Washington, even though it was Washington that created the problem. I mean, there is a reason, Rick, that public opinion polls have taken the greatest and most precipitous slide for any American president in modern times. I mean, Joe Biden's support is, he'll never win another election, and neither will any of them.
Well, don't forget, we're all going to build back better, and all the infrastructure is going to cost zero. Not a penny if you earn under $400,000. It won't cost you a penny to spend $3.5 trillion. I think they called that fuzzy math years ago, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, look, how stupid do they think we are? American people have a lot of common sense, and they're not buying it anymore. And as you pointed out at the beginning, even the press, they're starting to scratch their heads. I guess they must have to fill up their gas tanks, too. I mean, the supply chain crisis is real. I've talked to people who are importing goods, whether it's in the toy business for Christmas or other goods, and they say if it's coming from Asia or China, it's not getting there by Christmas. If it's coming from America, it will. If it's coming from Europe, it might. But that is going to be something people remember. The empty shelves in the supermarkets and the toy stores and the big box stores, that will be Joe Biden's legacy, just like Jimmy Carter's was the supply chain crisis in gasoline and gas lines and gas rationing. He'll never recover from this, nor should he, because he caused it.
K K.T. McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And we do want to point you to K.T.'s article on Colin Powell, an opinion piece, the headline on it at foxnews.com, Colin Powell's Greatest Gift to Us All. K.T., as always, we are honored to have you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
7:57, it's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station.